Could you find your way out of a smoke-filled house at night? Remember, working smoke alarms save lives. Check the batteries are working regularly. Plan your escape route and make sure everyone practices how to get out. If there is a fire, get out, stay out, and call 999. Visit avonfire.gov.uk.
If you don't know what in the world is going on, you're just going to be the flotsam and jetsam up on the tide. Remember, whoever doesn't understand what's happening ain't playing with a full deck of cards. And if you think you can stand on the fence, you're the first one that'll suffer. And that's the truth.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, more bloodshed in Palestine this week, and we'll be talking about that in a minute. Also, as more terror laws, anti-terror laws, are on the cards, what really happened on 7/7? We talk about that 9 years on this week. We start this week by looking over to the Ukraine. Well, it's fallen off the headlines, but what's been going on over there? I'm joined by Giles Shorter and Patrick McAnally from Bristol Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity. Hi, Patrick. Hi, hello. Giles, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks.
It does seem as if most of the focus of the news over the last few weeks has shifted over to the Middle East, ISIS and all this sort of thing. So what's been happening over in, if you want to start, Giles, perhaps, what's been happening over in the Ukraine?
Well, the last couple of weeks in Ukraine has been very bloody weeks. A couple of weeks ago, there was still supposed to be at least lip service being paid by the junta in Kiev to a supposed unilateral ceasefire. But since then, despite the pleas from Russia and Germany and France, Poroshenko, the fraudulently elected president of Ukraine, could not move fast enough to embrace what he called Plan B.
Okay, well, Poroshenko, you say fraudulently elected. I would say no, because actually there was large parts of the country that didn't, that chose not to vote for him. So if you choose not to vote for him, it's not a fraudulent election, is it?
An election fought under circumstances where half of the population is disenfranchised, under circumstances of civil war into which the country was cast precisely by the fascist coup which put the current junta in power in Kiev and was supported by both the United States imperialism and by our own government. That I would call this definitely a fraudulent election. I mean, what you're saying would actually be seconded by the BBC. When they had the fascist junta take over initially, the BBC decided to call it the interim government, a lovely anodyne phrase rather hiding the origins of it. And then once Poroshenko had had a presidential election, an election called by the illegal government, from which, as I say, 50% of the people weren't involved, then the BBC relaxed a bit and are quite happy now to present it as being government versus rebels. And the reality is, the people the BBC calls the government, they are the rebels, just as surely as General Franco was the rebel against Spanish Republic and Spain.
Why do you make that connection? Because these are countries very, very far apart and completely dissimilar.
The connection is made there are good reasons for thinking about Spain right now. It's a measure of the relative decline in political maturity of the left in this country. When you think back to the 1930s, when the call for solidarity with the anti-fascists was very widely embraced. And right now, it's come as a bit of a surprise to some people that it should be seen as necessary to have something called the Bristol Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity Movement. But the fact is, it's a wake-up call to the left. It's time that we did start supporting those who resist against the violence of the imperialist ruling class, which is exported to these countries,
well, what about
we
the,
have a responsibility.
Giles, what about the violence of the armed so-called rebels in the east of the country? We've just heard today, for example, that Ukraine is saying the rebels will pay because missiles fired by them have killed 23 soldiers. That's just Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has vowed to find and destroy pro-Russian rebels who've killed 23 servicemen and wounded nearly 100 in a missile attack today. That's this very day. I mean, you're talking about the imperialists and Kiev as being violent, but surely, you know, it's six and one and a half dozen of the other. Both sides are violent.
Well, this even-handed approach, again, is one which the BBC would agree with. We don't see it that way. We see a situation where people, largely Russian-speaking population of the south and east of Ukraine, found themselves in a situation where they had a very bleak choice to make. Faced with the choice between, on the one hand, going under the heel of the Nazi jackboot, collaborationist tradition going all the way back to the Second World War, or resist. And they did the honourable thing and resisted.
But this so-called Nazi jackboot, that's backed by the European Union, isn't it? Yeah?
Well, precisely so. In fact, it's acting on behalf of Western imperialism, NATO and the European Union, because the grand strategy, not so grand, but in fact rather flagging at the moment, but the strategy of imperialism is precisely to contain and neutralise Russia and China. And for sure, this is an attack on Ukraine. It's an attack on the interests of the people of Ukraine, both politically and economically and militarily.
So do you think it's okay for the rebels to kill these 23 Ukrainian soldiers?
I think it's something we should celebrate when the rebels, they're not rebels, I'm falling into the wrong language again. They are resistance forces. And I most certainly think that when the resistance forces make progress against the forces of fascism, then we should be cheering them on and we should have solidarity with that, because they're doing it for us all.
Patrick, can you give us your take on what's been happening over the last couple of weeks, because it does seem that you know, what we're doing here is stoking up some kind of civil war. And I mean, if you imagine, say, something like this happened in Britain, if Bristol decided we didn't want to have anything to do with Westminster anymore, we started taking up arms against them and we started fighting back, wouldn't we expect the British Army to come into Bristol and sort us out?
Well, just to go back to the Ukraine for a second, what we've seen there is the president who was elected, Yanukovych, being ousted. Now, that is the thing which the BBC and a lot of other people don't seem to be focusing on. I'm just sort of rehashing a bit what Giles just said here. So, and being replaced with someone who was elected in undemocratic elections. So what we're saying here is that the people in the East are rebels on the BBC, right? And they're fighting a democratically elected government. That isn't actually what is happening.
Let's just go back to that election last month, because at the end of the day, what you're saying is, because of the situation in the country, you couldn't have had an election. Otherwise, they've got to at least have an attempt. And if parts of the country aren't voting, then, you know, still that's going to be a democratic election for those parts that are.
Well, no, they had a president, and when he started not doing what the EU and Western imperialism wanted him to do, but what the EU and Western imperialism wanted him to do, they threw all their toys out a pram in the West and imperialist world, and they started pushing against him. People like Victoria Nuland went onto the streets, American diplomats, and handed out food and supported the Maidan movement, trying to oust a democratically elected president, and supported the election of an extreme capitalist with fascist backers, who has launched a war not only on Russian speakers and the Russians in the East, but on communists, Trotskyists, and other members of the left, on the Jewish community they have had to form. They have actually been advised to leave Kiev by one of their rabbis because of the extreme right-wing elements taking power there. So they're just as Ukrainian as anyone else, and they have a right to have a say in who they want to be elected. And the point is that they didn't. They had their leader, he was ousted, and he was replaced by a right-winger with fascistic elements and openly fascist groups supporting him. And therefore, I believe that the people who do not support the EU, the IMF, Western imperialism and Western capitalism and fascism have a right to take up arms and fight against it, and I openly support their decision to do so. You know, and if you hear about them shooting shooting down helicopters, etc. They are, and rehashing a bit what Jal said here, but they have an absolute right to take on those what are actually superior forces and fight back.
But they should surely be doing that through the ballot box, not with the
Well, they did, and they have their president ousted. I mean, you can't win, you know. They had a president. They had their own political outlook. These people consider themselves as having closer ties to Russia in some cases. Some of them were communists. They had their situation in the Ukraine. He was overthrown and replaced by an extreme capitalist who exploits people. Capitalists exploit people. Fascists who kill people. And they have chosen, after being bombarded and shelled by right-wing superior forces, to take up arms and fight those right-wing superior forces, and good luck to them, to be quite honest with you. You know, fair play. It's, you should all be fighting fascists and capitalists, you know.
Well, capitalists. Why was you? I mean, surely capitalism is perfectly legitimate as an organ, as a force in the world. And just because someone's a capitalist, it's no reason that they should be killed.
Well,
surely.
I don't believe in the exploitation of the workforce. I don't believe in capitalism. I'm speaking in personal capacity.
Well, yeah, but
here,
surely
but
you can argue against it. You don't have to kill people. You don't.
Well,
have
the
to
killing's
shoot
been started by the Poroshenko regime, who are shelling people in the east. When Trotskyists and communists did democratically take to the streets during the Maidan movement to give out leaflets, trade union leaflets. I report back from Ukraine, they have their ribs broken and were CS gassed and were actually attacked by the members of the right sector. So they did try to behave democratically initially. They took to the streets and leafleted and they were beaten up. We've now got underground movements in places like Kiev, where recently people went out and spray painted pictures of Vladimir Lenin on walls, who were so scared for their lives that they could be killed. And that isn't a democracy where communists and people who hold those beliefs that a workforce should not be exploited for profit, a face being killed for just spray painting a picture of Vladimir Lenin on a wall, you know. And if they take up arms and fight the establishment that's doing that, then fair play to them, you
so
know.
Do you think that Putin over the border in Russia is giving them a little bit of help, you know, somehow through maybe by clandestine Russian forces? Because we know there is some evidence that the West seems to be doing that through some mercenaries and things like that.
Well, we've had mixed reports, but the point is I've heard reports from the ground in Ukraine which say a lot of the people in the east are fighting with extremely primitive weaponry, which would suggest it hasn't necessarily come from Russia. There's been, you know, Kalashnikovs, stones in some cases, people fighting back with quite primitive weaponry. Yes, we have had reports of more high-powered weaponry shooting down those planes and helicopters, etc. And if it's come from Russia, then, you know, or what could you say? People are going to use it, aren't they? If they're being shelled by what is a superior force for Ukrainian far-right and capitalistic, extreme capitalistic government, and
if I just add to that...
Can you explain how you think this is, which direction you think this is heading in, Giles? Because, I mean, there are two, I suppose, schools of thought here. One is that there's going to be some kind of separation of the territory where there's going to be two states in Ukraine. The east, which is mostly Russian-speaking, will separate and become two different places. Or the other alternative, I suppose, the way it looks at the moment, is some kind of really protracted civil war, something along the lines of Yugoslavia.
It's very hard to second guess this. What we do know is what we know of the fascist junta in Kiev, and of the fact that they are so unwilling to enter into any kind of negotiations with intermediaries, in spite of the good offices of Russia and also Germany and France have been pushing diplomatic solutions. Under those circumstances, it is hard to see what peaceful outcome there can be. I don't know is the short answer to that. All I know is where the responsibility or our responsibility lies in the working class in this country, and that is to be having solidarity with those who are taking up a battle which they didn't seek, fighting a civil war which they are not responsible for, because it's our government and the US government
and the EU.
Well, and the EU. Okay. And the EU, except that it's interesting. I mean, the truth is, clearly, that the resistance is outgunned at the moment. It's having to melt away from some of its strongholds and retrench in more defensible towns.
Amnesty are accusing them today of some very serious rights abuses. Hundreds of people have been abducted and subjected to horrific beatings in eastern Ukraine, according to Amnesty International. After the collapse of the pro-Russian government of President Yanukovych in February, Russia seized control of Crimea, and separatists in the east of the country have been fighting Ukrainian government forces. Amnesty's report has gathered information on abductions and attacks such as beatings and torture meted out to activists, protesters and journalists in Kyiv, as Kyiv lost its hold over the region. And I'm just going to quote from Amnesty now. With hundreds abducted over the last 3 months, the time has come to take stock of what's happened and stop this abhorrent ongoing practice, said Amnesty's Denis Krivoshev. So Amnesty seem to be wading in on the opposite side, Giles. They're saying that that actually there's been some really unacceptable behaviour, abductions, that sort of thing going on in the East.
Would this be the same Amnesty that at the time of NATO attacks on Libya and on the Green Revolution there, and upon Gaddafi's leadership, is this the same the same Amnesty which spread the lie, helped us spread the lie that Gaddafi was using recruiting black mercenaries to defend his government, and a lie which was subsequently proven to be a lie because it was clearly African workers and others who were living in Libya. But by the time the truth came out about Amnesty's false allegations, what had happened? You had mass lynchings of black inhabitants in Tawerga. Is it the same Amnesty, we could ask, about that's also had an appalling position on Syria?
Well, I'll answer you, yes. It probably is the same Amnesty.
Well, it is the same Amnesty.
Patrick, can I just
I could just finish, this question about alleged rough treatment of people taken prisoner by the resistance forces.
This is evidence by Amnesty.
I'm sure you could point the finger also at the French resistance when they were faced with saboteurs and spies and traitors. I don't think they showed a great deal of mercy in those days.
Patrick, we're in a situation now where there's been a couple of ceasefires that have broken down, but we're hearing at the moment that that Ukraine is, I think that was Wednesday this week, that there is going to be no more unilateral ceasefires. Ukraine will only negotiate with the rebels once they lay down their arms, Kyiv's defence minister said this week. There will be no more unilateral ceasefires, and he's speaking after separatists fled their eastern strongholds and regrouped in the regional centre of Donetsk. Ukrainian forces recaptured several cities after President Petro Poroshenko brought an end to the 10-day ceasefire. Now, this is the old phrase, governments killing their own people. Certainly, that was that seems to be what's going on here. The army's being sent in to areas where people, it seems, are almost being forced to take up arms against them. But what are your thoughts about this move by the Kyiv government to say, actually, we're not really going to have any more ceasefires, we're not going to have any negotiations until they lay down their arms?
Right, well, there's a couple of points about I'd like to make. The first one I'd make is, was that actually a proper ceasefire the first time? Because we've had comrades on the ground in Ukraine who reported that during this so-called ceasefire, Poroshenko's government were stockpiling machinery and weapons and ammunition at the border, preparing for a major assault on the east. So that's one point I'd make. Was it a genuine ceasefire, or was it a regroupment operation for the fascists and the capitalists, extreme capitalists, getting ready to final annihilation of the people in the east? Point one. Point two, about the current situation with, the battles taking place, is that I think what we're going to see is the Ukrainian forces continue to advance. I think we're going to see them continue to kill. There's been endless photos of children, innocents, civilians, dead. And I think they're not going to stop until they are stopped. And I think that we're going to see the rebels continue to fight as long as they can. And I'm going to be rooting for people fighting against fascism. So I can't comment on how long it will take, I can't comment on what exactly will happen, but I think that it is going to be quite a bloody conflict. I mean, it is already a bloody conflict, and it's going to continue to be.
Martin, I asked Giles earlier on, what's your thoughts about which way this is going to go? Which road? Is it going to be two separate countries there, or is it just going to carry on and on like Yugoslavia?
Well, as what wasn't pointed out earlier is there were elections in Luhansk and Donetsk which elected their own leadership. And Poroshenko did have support in the West, including fascists. The fascists have electoral support in the West. The obvious thing to do is what Lavrov and Putin have been saying, is everybody stop shooting, let's negotiate this situation, which is exactly what happened in Yugoslavia. I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 90s, and there were continuous ceasefires. Ceasefires broke down, attempts were made to try and resolve the issues. And of course the German capital in particular is not very happy with what's happening, and they are in fact being pushed into this by the US. You mentioned Victoria Nuland, who famously told the EU to F off. Mm-hmm. But of course, the other key fact which people need to understand is that the shootings in the Maidan on February the 22nd, Umas Piets, who is the Estonian foreign minister, he was bugged, presumably by the Ukrainian or Russian secret services, speaking to Catherine Ashton, who's the foreign representative of the EU, and he was saying, "I've just been to the hospitals, I've spoken to the doctors, they are convinced that the shootings came from the Hotel Ukraine, which is actually under the control of Pravi Sector." So in other words, the shootings at the very beginning of all of this, which led to the coup, were carried out by Pravi Sector, not by Yanukovych. And of course, people who watch the Russian media are very well aware of this. They've picked up on all of this and carried on speaking about it. And of course, Umas Piets, as an Estonian, is not inclined to be pro-Russian. So when he says this, it's likely to be true. Mm-hmm. But of course, the Western media have ignored what's a pretty obvious provocation. Now, I think that was the key to what's been going on. And of course, it actually fits in with what NATO have been doing for years. They carry out terrorist attacks, which they blame on their opponents, and then they use them as a mechanism for creating war. It's quite clear that the US does not want peace here. They're not looking for peace. They're looking to draw the Russian army over the border into a fight so that they can start sanctions against Russia, which of course then prevents Germany developing a cooperative relationship with Russia. So what this is all about really is preventing the Russians and the Germans developing a cooperative relationship going forward.
Okay.
To suit US imperialism.
Okay, fascinating insight, Martin. I think it's quite a good summary. Can you guys, Patrick and Giles, tell us where we can find your group online or elsewhere?
Well, one place you can find us is going to be on Monday outside the BBC in White Ladies Road from 5 o'clock till 6:30. We're going to be standing there. It seems like an obvious place to go and stand. It's not just the BBC, it's also all the imperialist media, but it's not a bad focus to start from. In terms of getting in touch with us, well, I suggest if you Google Bristol Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity or BUAFS,
or another search engine, not necessarily Google.
Yep. I'm not advertising
really
here.
Fancy,
Then you can readily find us.
Okay.
There's going to be a meeting on the 23rd of July in the Ark, in the Palestinian Museum in Ark.
On Broad Street?
On Broad Street, yep. Correct, Broad Street. 7 o'clock on the 23rd of July, so very welcome to very hope to see people there.
Okay, Patrick McAnally and Giles Shorter, you're from Bristol Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity. Thanks very much for joining us on the Drive Time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And I'm joined on the line now by Neil Faulkner. Hi, Neil, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you.
Neil, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? Because I know you're doing a talk very soon, aren't you, in Bristol?
No, I've done it already, actually.
Oh, have you? I managed to miss it.
Yes.
Yes, explain what that was about.
Well, I was introducing a showing of Oh, What a Lovely War at Frome, at the invitation of the Frome Stop the War Coalition. And that's because I'm an archaeologist and historian, but also an anti-war activist who's quite heavily involved in No Glory, which is the campaign set up by Stop the War and others to put an alternative view about the First World War to that being put by both the government and right-wing historians who are arguing that the First World War was necessary.
There is a lot of evidence, wasn't there, that at the time that something was brewing up. Why would you say that the First World War wasn't necessary then? Because we've heard, for example, from Michael Gove, haven't we, the Education Secretary,
Absolutely.
That actually it was a righteous war.
Yes, indeed. And I think the problem with the way in which the First World War is being reinterpreted, and it really is a reinterpretation, is that the frame is far too narrow, and what's being looked at is the minutiae of diplomatic negotiations that are going on, particularly in the July crisis of 1914. And then there's an attempt to try and put the blame on one group of leaders as opposed to another. Whereas the reality is that all of the different political elites were representing a minority of their respective populations. They were representing the bankers, the industrialists, the arms manufacturers, the rich. They were representing the people who were interested in empire. And the First World War was fundamentally a contest between two rival European alliances for empire. And Britain's rulers were no different from Germany's rulers in that respect. In actual fact, they were bigger imperialists, far bigger imperialists than the Germans. They'd engaged the Germans in a naval arms race to protect that empire. And they had formed alliances in Europe as a way of trying to contain Germany, all part and parcel of this business of trying to protect their own empire. And from the point of view of ordinary people, whether they were working people in Britain or Germany or Russia or Austria, really they had no interest whatsoever in going to war with each other. They were all being enrolled in a war in the interests of their own economic and political elites. It was a war for the rich that was fought in by ordinary working people, and they were the ones, they were the victims.
Is there any lesson to be learned, you think, from the film? I know I remember going to see it down at the cinema, I think back in 1969, Oh What a Lovely War, and I was very dismayed. For many years, actually, it wasn't available as either as a VHS video or as a DVD. It only came out about four or five mm-hmm. years ago. So tell us a little bit about the film, because obviously that was the big highlight of the evening. I'm not saying that your talk wasn't, but, you know, this is a film which I think, you know, I'm very surprised and rather annoyed that it still doesn't seem to have been shown on mainstream television this year, especially with the 100-year celebrations of, or not celebration, commemoration of the First World War.
No, I think it's an absolutely tremendous film. I mean, artistically, it's very interesting in that it's a kind of, it's satire in the form of a kind of theatre of the absurd. And one has to accept, of course, that it's not an accurate historical account. It is exactly that. It's a dramatic performance, and it's a political satire. But what I think it does is it captures the essence of the situation, where there is this sort of great power diplomacy which is playing out at the beginning of the war, and this transforms into a horrendous war of attrition. And that's what's being very effectively depicted in the scene, in the film, where you've got a war that grinds on and on and on, and each offensive is supposed to be the offensive that's going to end the war, but each one fails, and so next time they need even more men, even more guns, even more shells. And there's a particularly striking scene, it seems to me, where Douglas Haig, who is played by John Mills, is explaining in all seriousness that given the rate at which Germans are being killed and the rate at which Britons are being killed, he's calculated that if all of the Germans are killed, there'll still be some Britons alive, and therefore we will have won the war. And although that's a satirical way of presenting the realities of what was going on, the core of truth in that is that it was a war of attrition, in which the process of killing on the battlefield had been turned into an industrial process. Now, that's got to be insane. It's got to be the product of a world gone mad. And that's the lesson we need to learn, and to understand why it happened, and to understand that that was a product of a profoundly dysfunctional system.
It was, wasn't it? And also, one of the fascinating things for me was that it actually was, has also been nicknamed the Cousins War, because it was made, the three main protagonists being Tsar Nicholas from Russia, Kaiser Wilhelm, and the British King. You better remind me, was it George? At the
George had become king by then, George V. Yes.
So these three were all cousins. It was almost like a kind of a family disagreement that got out of hand.
Yes. I mean, and yet, of course, the fact that there was the family relationship between the different members of the European royal houses didn't prevent the war. And that, in a way, is an indication that it wasn't really about the personal relationships between the different rulers. It was actually about far more powerful forces that were out of control. And, you know, and that was the force of growing industrial power, growing capitalist power, which created competing banking syndicates and competing industrial conglomerates that were seeking markets, seeking raw materials, seeking opportunities to invest capital abroad, and that was bringing their political, their respective political leaderships into conflict with each other, and that in turn was leading to the build-up of these great war machines that then sort of explode onto the stage of history in 1914.
Now, we've just been talking about the Ukraine. We'll be talking in a minute about Israel and Palestine. Mm. What do you think the lessons are from Oh, What a Lovely War, from your studies of the real causes mm-hmm. behind the First World War for us today?
I think, in a sense, we are still in a world that hasn't changed very much. It's still a world dominated by imperialism, dominated by great powers, a world in which military power is often being projected by powerful states like Britain, like France, like the United States, like Russia. Military power is being projected in order to protect the interests of the powerful economic elites that are based in those different countries. And when those imperialist wars are fought, they are never fought in the interests either of the ordinary folks at home or the people who are on the receiving end of the violence. So that, in a way, the centenary of the First World War is also the centenary of the beginning of a century of war driven by industry, driven by imperial conflict, driven by the great powers, driven by the rich. And many of us feel that we need to campaign in the anti-war movement and more generally against the system that produces war. We need to campaign in the early 21st century in a very, very serious way to make sure that we don't have another century of war like the one that has just passed.
Isn't the problem that maybe war is always going to be with us, Neil?
Well, I would like to think not. I mean, I would like to think as a historian that we can explain why wars happen. We can explain them in terms of a dysfunctional geopolitical system and a system which is a global system which is dominated by profit and competition instead of a global system dominated by cooperation to create the goods and services that we all need, and a political system which has solidarity and internationalism and peace at the heart of it. I can imagine that we could, as human beings, construct such a system, but we're going to have to fight for major changes to get there.
Okay, Neil, finally, could you just tell us about some of your writings, maybe magazine articles, that sort of thing, where people can follow up some of your work?
Well, I am actually a magazine editor. I edit Military History Monthly, which is a regular magazine which is for military history enthusiasts. But I'm also a practicing archaeologist, and I've spent the last 10 years working on a project in Jordan where we've been investigating the archaeology of the First World War. That's essentially Lawrence of Arabia's war. And I'm currently working on a book on that subject, as is my colleague. We've got two books, in fact, we're working on. They're both going to come out at the same time, timed for the centenary of the outbreak of the Arab Revolt and the involvement of Lawrence in the desert in 2016. So that to come.
Okay, historian Neil Faulkner, very sorry to introduce you as someone who's about to introduce a talk, but actually you did it a few days ago. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Bye-bye.
And Martin, I just wonder if I can pick up with you on there. I mean, we did this whole series, didn't we, of Paul Mason's First World War. What do you think the lessons are? I mean, I asked Neil this question, I'll ask you. What can we learn from the First World War to stop wars today?
Well, I'm afraid that the situation we're in is very similar to the situation in 1914. It's rather horrifying. And, of course, we've got ISIS supposedly expunging the border between Syria and Iraq. That border was created by the Arab Revolt and the Sykes-Picot Agreement and so on. And I'm afraid that what happens with wars is that they just create the conditions for further wars. And the imperialist competition that we're now facing is very similar to what we saw in the run-up to 1914, except that everybody's now got nuclear weapons. God help us all.
Well, God help us all indeed. But that's one of the things that many people are saying in the Middle East at the moment as well, because we've had a horrendous couple of weeks, beginning with the kidnap and killing of three young Israelis, and then all sorts of reprisals. What's your take on what's been going over there on the last couple of weeks, Martin?
Well, let's presume, for the sake of argument, that the three Israelis that were kidnapped by Palestinians, although there's no evidence to suggest that that is the case. In actual fact, the head of Mossad spoke to the Israeli cabinet the week before, and he said to them, what would you do if three teenage girls were kidnapped from the settlements? And then the next week, three teenage boys were kidnapped. Now, let's just...
Well, it was also, just let me add this, it was on the Israeli Defence Forces magazine as well, the front page of that, just the week before, about warning of the dangers of kidnap.
Yes, OK, so we've got the dangers of kidnap, but in actual fact, whether or not they were kidnapped by the Palestinians, there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that they were kidnapped by Hamas. And Netanyahu seized on the incident immediately to say, oh, well, Hamas did this. So what they've been doing is attacking Hamas, arresting their activists, killing their people, including families and random people who happen to be in the way. They've taken this as an excuse to assault Hamas, because of course Hamas have just come into coalition with the Palestinian Authority led by Abbas. Now let's just remind people that who won the election in Palestine, the last free election, was indeed Hamas, and the Israelis are totally unwilling to accept them as interlocutors. So they've taken this incident and used it as an excuse to basically carry out mayhem in Gaza and the West Bank.
Okay, let's go back a couple of weeks to that kidnapping. Amazingly enough, there was a recording made by one of the young boys before he was killed, Gilad Shear, and that emergency call was broadcast by the Israeli police, and also Lindsay Hilson reported it on Channel 4 News.
An emergency call made by Gilad Shear. They kidnapped me, he says. Today, the Israeli police released the recording. The kidnappers seem to realize what's happening. They shout, head down, in Hebrew, and what could be shots can be heard in the background. In Hebron last night, Israeli soldiers raided the house of Amar Abu Aisha, one of two Palestinians suspected of kidnap and murder.
Well, certainly suspects, but the interesting thing she's saying there is that the kidnappers actually were using Hebrew it may be that they've just learnt Hebrew, they were from Hamas, but that is quite an interesting angle to this, which doesn't really seem to have come out much.
No, and we know for exactly from the Lavon affair in the 1950s, where bomb attacks were carried out in Egypt, which were blamed on Islamic extremists. The Egyptian police captured those who were planting the bombs. It turned out they were Mossad. Now, in other words, Mossad have got a track record of carrying out terrorist attacks and blaming it on other people.
Don't every side do this?
Yes, I'm afraid they do, Tony. And therefore, we can't necessarily take at face value what anybody says about anything here. But just as we were talking about Ukraine a minute ago, ultimately, there has to be a negotiated solution to this crisis and to this situation. Ultimately, the Israelis have to settle for the 1967 borders, which the UN awarded them, and they have to retreat from occupied territory.
Well, we're hearing also today that roughly 100 people now have died in Gaza as part of the assault by the Israeli military.
Mostly women and children. Now, ultimately, this is intolerable. And, of course, you could say that if the Israelis are going to carry on attacking and killing and occupying land that they're not entitled to, then there's no point negotiating with them. We'll just have to fight with them. When I say we, I don't just mean the Palestinians. I mean everybody is going to have to fight with them, because we're not pacifists, are we? Ultimately, we have to defend ourselves. And the Israelis should understand that if they carry on fighting, they will have to fight, and they will lose.
The Guardian's just reporting that Israel's Gaza campaign might actually violate international law.
Well, it does. It obviously violates international law, because it's collective punishment of everybody on the basis of... I mean, and it's not even clear that they know who kidnapped they knew for a fact that the three of them had been killed anyway. When they were saying they'd been kidnapped and they were searching for them, they already knew that they'd been killed, and they knew where the bodies were. But they used it as an excuse to hit Hamas.
And I think
in other words, they're trying to prevent a peace deal by using the incident, Whether they cooked up the incident is another question. I think, but it's certainly a legitimate question, given what we know of the way Mossad operates.
It may be a bald way of looking at it, but we're looking at something like 100 killed on the Palestinian side, and I think it's now 4 killed altogether on the Israeli side.
Well, exactly. I mean, the Israelis are like us, though. They have credit cards, and they go shopping, and they go to the beach. They're not like those Arabs who don't talk the sort of language we talk.
Ultimately, Martin,
and
this
live
is
in a totally different way from us.
They're
British, not the same at all.
The British created the State of Israel at the end of the Second World War in the 1940s. Really, this is largely our problem too, isn't it?
It is indeed. And when I say that if the Israelis want to fight to hold on to the occupied territories, then the whole world should pick up that challenge and fight with them.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Fran Scott's joining us now from London, and she has been looking into something called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Now, Fran, hi, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there, Tony.
Tell us, first of all, what is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership?
Well, it's to create a massive free trade, so-called free trade area, across the EU and the US to harmonise trade regulations, and it's the biggest free trade area that's going to be created in history. But there's been an awful lot of criticisms of it. The whole negotiations have been completely secret. Basically, it's nothing about trade, and it's all about a corporate takeover.
Okay, who's behind it?
The European Round Table of Industrialists.
Oh, not them again.
Yes.
Okay, these are the guys that cook up most of the new laws for the European Union, aren't they?
Exactly.
There was a very, very good documentary all about them where some people from Corporate Europe Observatory that I can remember sharing an office with for over a weekend a few years ago managed to break into their office. Just to remind us, who is that group again? And they're, this is amazing that it's them as well.
Well, basically, they're 50 CEOs from multinational companies, and basically they were taking up this idea of a massive free trade area, and way back in the 1990s, and Angela Merkel, Germany's Chancellor, took it up. And in 2007, representatives from the European Roundtable of Industrialists met with the European Commission and the US government and decided to set up this TTIP.
Okay, so what is it going to do, TTIP? What's it going to do? TTIP, that sounds much better than TTIP. Yes, TTIP.
Well, the Professor of International Law from Helsinki in December 2013, Marty Koskenniemu, warned that TTIP had a dangerous effect on our democracy. It's a threat to our jobs, to the NHS, basically it's a race to the bottom because it's supposedly harmonising trade regulations between the EU and the US. And what that means in practice is that food safety standards, environmental standards, labour standards, etc., are all going to be affected. So we're going to be forced to have things like chlorinated meat coming into the EU, which the US presently have on their tables to eat. They will be pushing genetically modified food and crops onto the EU, whether we like it or not.
So that's basically treating meat, chlorinated meat, is treating meat with this stuff which is actually pretty poisonous. I mean, I when I was at school, there was a lad that took a sniff of chlorine, he just completely passed out for hours and was taken off in an ambulance. This stuff's not very good for you, but it helps. It's good for the shelf life, but it's not good for us when we're eating it.
Exactly. And basically, they've got something called the ISDS, which is the Investor State Dispute Settlement, where corporations are going to be allowed by the TTIP through the ISDS to sue governments if they think that their regulations are so-called barriers to trade.
But a lot of these big corporations, Fran, they're telling us that this is going to create jobs.
Well, that's very unlikely because already there's been examples where Viola actually sued the Egyptian government for daring to raise the minimum wage in Egypt. And that kind of thing will happen if we sign the TTIP. And the TTIP is due to be signed in December this year. And so there's been a massive resistance to it. You've got the International Trade Union Congress that met only a couple of months ago. They're all against it. Many, many trade unions in the UK they have come out against it, like the NUT, Unite, the GMB Union. There's over 250 organisations such as War on Want, Friends of the Earth, the World Development Movement. They've all signed petitions, and 38 Degrees have a petition online if you'd like to go on it and sign it. We can win.
But a petition won't stop it, will it?
No, but, you know, with our massive resistance against it, we can win. We did defeat other similar trade deals. You know, the thing is that there's been a lot of media silence on this, mainstream media silence, that is. Hopefully tomorrow, that might not be the case, because there's a big demonstration. There's demonstrations throughout the EU and the US coordinated together on tomorrow, across the EU and the Europe.
Okay, Fran, thanks very much. Now, Martin, your take on this, I think, is along the lines of, it's a kind of attempt to weld together the US or North America with the European Union into one giant, basically one legal jurisdiction, so that companies, corporations, can actually, anybody that affects their growing profits can be sued and taken out.
Yes, indeed. And of course, it also, what we were talking about Ukraine earlier, it means that the Germans and the Europeans can't develop constructive relationships with Russia. I'd be very interested here.
Why is that? Why?
Well, because what's happened in Ukraine, the TTIP is being pushed on the West, for example, in terms of fracking, because they're saying, we'll have to sign this deal so that we can frack, so that we can then supply you with gas, because you don't want to be supplied with gas by those terrible Russians who've done all this terrible stuff in the Ukraine. So it's all part of rushing everybody quickly to the altar and get it. It's like a shotgun wedding. And I'd be very interested to hear what Nigel Farage or other Tory right-wingers who don't like the EU have got to say about this. Because the EU is about to sign over everything we want, all of our rights, to the United States of America. And I'll bet you loads of Tories are actually in favour of this deal, even though they oppose the EU.
Actually, that is true. Yes, that is absolutely true, Martin, because the only parliamentary, all-party parliamentary group that's specifically looking at the TTIP is all full of MPs that are pro the TTIP. Most of them are condemn MPs, and surprise, surprise, a lot of them have got shares in companies that are going to profit from the TTIP if it gets signed.
OK, well, Fran from... Fran Scott from... Pax Vista TV in London, our London correspondent. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, I promised it for the last few weeks, but we're going to hear now from a propaganda film made by North Korea. This is looking at the West from North Korea's eyes. I'm having a chat with Martin afterwards about what he thinks of some of the points they make in this North Korean propaganda film.
And just 6 months after his re-election, on a stay-out-of-the-war pledge, President Woodrow Wilson declared war on Germany.
And a League of Nations.
While the British abandoned propaganda in peacetime, the Americans maintained its use under the leadership of Creel Commission psychologist Edward Bernays, who argued that American public opinion must be engineered from above by society's few masters. The 1%. To control the rabble. The business world then turned to Bernays to indoctrinate citizens with the capitalist story until the masses willingly adopted the idea that America is a country of big business, by big business, and for big business. Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism, because it is a merger of state and corporate power. Benito Mussolini. Meanwhile, Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels was openly thanking the British and Americans for their propaganda model and put it to good use for rallying the German people to war.
Yeah! 역사적 자료들을 보면 괴벨이
historical documents prove that Goebbels ordered stormtroopers to burn down the German Reichstag, which he blamed on the communists.
명령하였다는 것을 증명하고 있다. 이 사건들은
This had the desired effect of frightening the population, who surrendered their civil rights and enabled the Nazis to swiftly transform Germany from republic to fascist state and launch World War II. 35 million lives were given up in World War II in patriotic fervor created by propaganda campaigns. As if using propaganda to send their pacifist population to war wasn't bad enough, consider how America repaid its people for defeating the Nazis. Operation Paperclip. Operation Paperclip was the safe transfer of Nazi scientists and operatives into the CIA. Nazis like Josef Mengele, the infamous Angel of Death, who carried out live experiments on humans in the death camps. These death industry pros were given new identities as US citizens and employed in U.S. laboratories to develop a dazzling array of mind control programs for the CIA, as well as new products and ideas for U.S. biochemical warfare expansion.
Ultimately, they discovered LSD, all that drug stuff.
General Electric, DuPont,
Not only did companies like General Electric, DuPont, Ford and Bell help with Operation Paperclip, but so did Americans like Prescott Bush, the patriarch of the presidents George Bush. Documents in the National Archives and Library of Congress show that he committed treason continuously between 1924 and 1951. First, by using Jewish slave labor in collusion with the Nazis, and then by bringing those Nazis and their assets into America. Despite being a traitor to his country, this Nazi collaborator became a senator, and his family has assumed great power in America. But they are not the only fascist family to thrive from tyranny against humanity. Court records show that the Rockefeller Standard Oil Company was selling more oil to Hitler's war effort than to the Allies. And for this, a federal judge ruled John D. Rockefeller committed treason against the United States. Treason, the most heinous crime of all. Prior to World War II, this man joined fellow traitor Prescott Bush and the British royal family in sponsoring the eugenics initiative that gave rise to Hitler's racial hygiene program.
Anyway, Martin, that goes on for about an hour and a half, I think. It's a leaked, so-called leaked, anyway, documentary online from North Korea, which is very critical of the West. But, I mean, they make some quite barbed points, don't they? Just give us your take on North Korea, because actually freedom of speech and things like that are quite curtailed there, aren't they?
They are. I mean, the sort of things they were saying there are the sort of things that are not said in the mainstream in the West. On this programme, we've covered Operation Paperclip, for example, and collaboration between NATO intelligence services and the Nazis quite extensively, but not in the mainstream. And, of course, that's the sort of thing the North Koreans would say because they are trying to defend themselves from being attacked by the West. Now, the North Korean state itself is not exactly a liberal democracy, but you could argue that this is a result of, you know, decades, for example, of Japanese imperialism in Korea, because Korea was originally a Japanese colony for from the 1900s, and the Japanese were extremely brutal, and a communist movement grew up which was trying to kick out the Japanese. Similarly, as the communist movement grew up in Vietnam, was on the back of trying to kick out the French. And then, of course, the Americans get engaged because they want to stop the communists taking power. So, I mean, the Korean War was a tragedy which still continues And I'm afraid the North Korean state is not really a model for socialists around the world in terms of wouldn't it be like nice to live in North Korea. But on the other hand, we've got to try and diffuse the situation with North Korea in such a way that peace can be preserved in the 21st century, because millions of people already died in Korea in the 1950s.
Well, you say that, but there is also evidence, isn't there, that the North Koreans have got nuclear weapons?
Well, they've got nuclear weapons, no doubt about it. And it's been suggested to me by sources I cannot name that those nuclear weapons that they have, in fact, were one nuclear bomb from South Africa, a uranium bomb, and one plutonium bomb lost by the Americans off Somalia in the 1990s. In other words, they haven't actually got their own independent nuclear capacity. They've bought black market Western weapons from the South Africans and from the Americans.
But ultimately, these weapons, are they actually going to be used? Because surely the whole point of nuclear weapons is you don't use them, you just keep them in order to keep your enemies at bay.
Well, that's exactly how the North Koreans are using them. They're saying, look, don't mess with us, we have got nuclear weapons, and if you try and invade us, for example, we might drop one of them on Japan, so think twice. And from their point of view, it makes a lot of sense. There needs to be a de-escalation of tension. It's the Korean War. It was North Korea that invaded the South initially, but then once they'd been driven back to the 39th parallel, MacArthur then invaded the North. So in other words, it was six of one and half a dozen of the other, and millions of civilians died. I mean, there was outright direct bombing of civilian targets in North Vietnam. They chucked everything they'd got at them, thousands, hundreds of thousands of civilians in North Korea were killed by British and American bombs. And of course, the families still remember, and it's not that straightforward. We're not 100% good, they're not 100% bad. Like most wars in history, could have been avoided if everybody's shown a bit more common sense.
I mean, we're looking at the moment, aren't we, at massive amounts of money being spent, even though we've got austerity supposedly on our own nuclear deterrent. Is it time to say goodbye to that? Is there any real justification for it anymore?
Well, I say the North Koreans have got a much better justification for having nuclear weapons than we've got.
Do you think that we do need to renew this Trident?
Absolutely
and the many
not.
Billions to spend on it?
It's unusable. The North Koreans are genuinely threatened. The Iranians are not developing nuclear weapons, but it would be perfectly logical if they did, given that their enemies, all of their enemies, have got masses of nuclear weapons.
OK, thanks, Martin. Thanks also to Mark Weston, who's the Conservative leader on Bristol City Council, and he's also councillor for Henbury in the first hour. Thanks also to Neil Faulkner, his magazine, Military Times. Get it. Bristol. Subscribe. I'm Tony Gosling. This show is online at thisweek.org.uk. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu says international pressure will not stop him acting against the people he describes as terrorists. It's claimed more than 100 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes this week as the military reacts to hundreds of rockets fired from Gaza into Israel. Palestinian legislator Hanan Ashwari says Israel's response is unfair.
We have chosen nonviolent resistance. We've asked for a two-state solution. Instead, we're constantly being battered and bashed. We cannot control the responses of every single faction or Palestinian individual. When you are living under such a cruel military occupation, that has deprived you of all your rights.
A schoolboy has admitted the manslaughter of his teacher, who was stabbed at a school in Leeds. Anne Maguire was attacked in her classroom at Corpus Christi Catholic College in April.